This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, there is much change focused in on healthcare, health reform, and health policy.
Well, indeed there is. And in the aftermath of the election, President-elect Trump and the Republican majority in Congress are making much of the notion that the Affordable Care Act needs to be repealed and in short order. But most experts say it's not going to be easy to pull the plug on the full legislation without a sound replacement strategy, which under any circumstances, it's kind of hard to undo legislation, Mark, isn't it?
No, it is. And many of the nation's healthcare CEOs are uncertain how a change in federal policy will affect their bottom lines until they know what Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements will look like. And the years ahead, a majority are certainly urging the Trump administration to proceed cautiously before greatly disrupting the policies that have been in place for several years now.
And there's also concern about what the Trump administration will mean for things like scientific and biomedical research and programs like the Cancer Moonshot, the Precision Medicine Initiative. These are things our guest today is very involved with.
Dr. Keith Yamamoto is Vice Chancellor for Science Policy and Strategy at the University of San Francisco School of Medicine. He has some unique insights in what may lie ahead for biomedical research.
Of course, Laurie Robertson will be checking in with us, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com. And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Keith Yamamoto in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. There's growing unease within the healthcare community as well as the health industry regarding the future of healthcare in America and exactly what policies are going to drive it forward. The nation's $3.5 trillion healthcare industry has recalibrated these past 6 years since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, and most industry insiders were not anticipating a Trump win in the presidential election. The president-elect has vowed to repeal and replace the law while keeping in place some of the more popular aspects, such as young adults staying on their parents' plans to age 26 and exemptions for pre-existing conditions. The hospital industry is particularly concerned over the potential of millions of Americans losing health coverage. The law has greatly reduced hospital reliance on charity funds to cover the uninsured in need of hospital care. Women's health services coverage are mandatory under the ACA. Those services could also be at risk. Some attempt to privatize Medicaid is likely, and attempts to expand private Medicare Advantage programs look to be fairly certain. 1964, a seminal moment in the history of the U.S. Surgeon General's office. Smoking was then directly related to a number of deadly conditions, including cancer. It has led over the decades to more targeted health policies that have curtailed the smoking habit significantly in this country. 2016 may prove to be a pivotal year for the nearly 21 million Americans beset by addiction. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy issued a report detailing addiction as a medical condition and one that's far undertreated and costs the nation some $420 billion a year in lost revenue, accrued health costs, and incarceration expenses. Dementia is now down among the nation's seniors. According to a study conducted by the National Institutes of Health, dementia has seen a 24% decline in Americans over age 65. The study suggests perhaps advances in heart health through better hypertension management and diabetes management may play a role. Still, the numbers are staggering. Currently, 5 million Americans suffer from dementia. That number expected to triple by 2050. And study on screen time in the developing brain was a topic for discussion at the annual gathering of the nation's neuroscientists. The study found mice brains exposed to 6 hours of lights and noises similar to video games had much more need for excitable stimulation than their counterparts, were more likely to exhibit high-risk behavior and had symptoms of ADD. But they were also less likely to become distressed in noisy, overstimulating environments that would upset those mice who weren't exposed. The report comes on the heels of the American Academy of Pediatrics relaxing its earlier stance on babies and screen time. Their previous recommendation was none before the age of 2. Either way, the study showed significant rewiring of brain circuitry in the overexposed mice. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Keith Yamamoto, PhD, Vice Chancellor for Science Policy and Strategy and Director of Precision Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. Dr. Yamamoto is also a leader in science policy, serving as Chairman of the Board on Life Sciences at the National Academy of Science, numerous government and public advisory boards, including the NIH Center for Scientific Review Advisory Council. Dr. Yamamoto is an elected member of the National Academy of Medicine and is a Fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He earned his doctorate in biochemical science at Princeton University. Dr. Yamamoto, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Welcome. Pleasure to join you.
You know, you've had just an incredible career in biomedical research, as well as a solid role as a thought leader in the world of national health and research policy. And you recently participated in a panel at Faster Cures Conference, where you weighed in on the opportunities and challenges for the president-elect. And I'm wondering if you could just share your views on the expectations that you might have coming out of a Trump administration around biomedical research.
Well, I think there's a lot of uncertainty. There are concerns about things that Trump said and did that might be cause for worry amongst scientists with respect to his using evidence as a basis for decisions and so forth. But I think that what you heard was a level of cautious optimism that it's important for us to sort of back up, take a deep breath, sit down, and talk with the new administration. You know, I think there are many things that they need to know about scientific research, biomedicine, healthcare, that we don't know how familiar they are with it. Mm-hmm. You know, among them, prompt appointment of the NIH and National Cancer Institute directors, really being able to draw for them the direct connection between biomedical research and health and healthcare and healthcare costs, including drug costs. The imperative that the federal government has to do basic research, really opening the door for the private sector to be able to apply that new knowledge. The opportunity that the administration has to support grand challenges, to enunciate big goals that the scientific community might take on with federal support that would have impacts on really urgent societal issues. And just the importance of maintaining U.S. leadership in biomedical research enterprise as a whole, maybe just pointing out the importance and role of biomedical research and medicine as an economic driver in our present economy. Mm-hmm. And it's really crucial that we sort of start with a blank slate, sit down, and try to talk about those needs.
Well, Dr. Yamamoto, I'm sure there's always a interesting array of thought leaders gathered at the Faster Cures Conference.
Right.
I know Dr. Francis Collins, head of the National Institutes of Health, who oversaw the Human Genome Project, was there. Certainly, he's been a very vocal advocate for more federal money earmarked for biomedical research. So the 21st Century Cures Act, we know, is a bipartisan bill. That's a good thing right there, launched in Congress. But what is the importance of that legislation?
Yeah, 21st Century Cures has been long in the making. Congressman Fred Upton, who's chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee in the House, has been assembling and promoting this legislation for a couple of years. A version of it actually passed the House last year but didn't proceed through the Senate, and it's being rewritten as we speak. And 21st Century Cures carries a broad spectrum of matters of support and regulation of research, drug discovery, drug testing, and drug approval at the FDA, research at the NIH, that I think capitalize well on the opportunities that have opened up with the big research advances that have been made over the past decade or two. That kind of research, it would move the NIH budget, which, as you know, has been in stasis for over a decade, finally being able to allow scientists to try to capitalize upon some of the advances that they've made. So a big bill covering fundamental science and then moving drug development, device development, and approval more briskly through the FDA.
Margaret just mentioned Dr. Collins heading up NIH, and he's also taken on the president's latest research initiative, the Precision Medicine Initiative. And you are as well a leader in this area at the University of California at San Francisco. Am I wrong to say that you all have your own initiative open to all of the 20,000 plus employees at the Institute. Maybe you could share with us what you are doing within the university around precision medicine.
So, you know, it's actually worth backing up a step and talking about the overall scope of precision medicine. I was chair of the Board on Life Sciences of the National Academy of Sciences that sanctioned this report, and that was beautifully chaired by then UCSF Chancellor Sue Desmond-Hellman and Charles Sawyers. It was a great report, made a series of recommendations that they really saw maybe three things, that to try to build a continuum of research so that all of biological information from fruit flies through populations of people could actually be used in decision-making about advancing further research on the one hand, and about diagnosis and treatment and prevention and cure of diseases in people. Secondly, to define disease mechanisms so that we can actually classify diseases according to mechanisms instead of symptoms and organs and things of that sort. And we're seeing examples already of being able to come across diseases that for which there's no present therapy, and then find that, oh, the mechanism is the same as this disease over here that looked unrelated, but now there's already a therapy already there. And then finally, to be able to discern all the factors that contribute to disease so that prevention, diagnosis, treatment, cure can be focused all the way down to the level of the individual. Those are grand goals, and that's what precision medicine really does. It's a revolutionary approach to research, health care, that seeks to integrate vast amounts of data in order to achieve those ends.
Well, Dr. Yamamoto, you have made the point so often that we're at a crossroads and that the academic world of biomedical research is also at an important pivot point. You supported the notion that the world of academia has to be redesigned in some ways to reflect the 21st century era of scientific advancement. You wrote a very compelling piece about the university of the future and why that needs to be given serious consideration and what you think it would look like.
You know, what's happened with these remarkable advances in research is that the sort of the lights have come on between fields that were thought not to be related, between ideas that weren't connected. And when those lights come on, the possibility of doing something really bold, of asking a big question that we hadn't been able to see before, becomes evident. And so this University of Future idea speaks to the fact that the traditions and policies for funding research, and on the other hand, amongst us, academia, are a conservative force that is actually inhibiting the capacity, or at least not encouraging the capacity for scientists to ask these bold questions because they don't get rewards for them. So that's what the University of Future says, is what if we put together a system, the self-assembly of teams of scientists who choose to go after a hard problem from multiple disciplines, teams that come together to say, hey, you know, if we work together, we have an opportunity to nail this problem. And we all know that there's no way we could do it individually. So the system of focusing on individual achievements in academia is holding back that possibility of groups of people getting together, choosing the problem by themselves, and going after it as teams. And the precision medicine approach, as you know, proposes building a huge computational so-called knowledge network that links together all kinds of information about biological processes, about disease, about people, and that will allow sort of visualization of these possibilities that you know, a single human brain can't really put all the stuff together, but a computer can. And so the idea is that in the University of Future, increasingly, we'll be able to sort of sit down at our terminals over lunch hour and find investigators who could, working together, go after a problem and solve it, a really bold idea. So we need to build a system that recognizes the value of that kind of team effort and rewards it.
We're speaking today with Keith Yamamoto, PhD, Vice Chancellor for Science Policy and Strategy, Executive Vice Dean for Research at the School of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. You've really had a revolutionary approach to this whole concept of how we should start conceptually thinking about where our research dollars go. And so much of the resource, the funding, really align with something that is really a siloed approach. But how do you sort of square that up with sort of the political funding aspects of the mm-hmm. research community?
Mm-hmm. You know, when resources are limited, and they are, then an intrinsic weakness, our system for funding research emerges, that the peer review system, which is the best way in the world to allocate research funds, becomes conservative. The research is being reviewed by peers, and their first line of defense is to defend the prevailing paradigm in a given area. Mm-hmm. And so a research grant application that comes in with a wild, crazy idea that's going to show that that paradigm is wrong is not going to be welcomed with open arms right away. And, of course, bold ideas have a risk for failure. The University of Future idea says that this idea of research teams would be stamped out multiple times per faculty member. Let's say that established lab faculty member might be involved in 10 teams. That'd be fantastic. You know, wake up every morning thinking about 10 problems that I know that I couldn't work on by myself. Mm-hmm. But because of these teams that I'm in, we're doing things that are really fantastic. Well, let's imagine team 4 fails because the technology we needed to develop that we thought we could develop, we couldn't. Team 10 fails because, in fact, the idea, as fantastic as it was wrong. Mm. So now 2 out of 10 have gone down in flames. But, you know, 3 other of the teams are really going great guns. They're going to really do something fantastic. And maybe 2 others look pretty good. And so failure becomes an option. And we're not so afraid to ask bold and crazy things because there's some of those things mm-hmm. are going to hit. Mm-hmm. If we can destigmatize failure in academic research, then the opportunity to ask and answer the really big questions opens up much more.
Well, Dr. Yamamoto, I think there's probably some parallels there from the way we approach educating the research professionals to thinking about the world of healthcare professional workforce training. What are your thoughts about the principles for transforming academia from the perspective of how we train the healthcare workforce of the future, and how is that training evolving at your institution?
Actually, there is a new medical curriculum called Bridges, UCSF Bridges, that has many elements of integration that I've been talking about built in, where the students begin to define and then act upon their refined interests in the medical profession. And so the opportunity for medical students at UCSF to be able to integrate with that world is greatly increased. But, you know, we're a long way from being there. On the PhD training side, there are still many programs around the country that kind of continue to use the conventional stand up and lecture and then examine the students to see how much they remember approach. You know, we're sort of past that now. We have in our pockets little devices that can remember everything. So being able to build concepts and use them effectively is really critical. And an increasing number of programs, including ours, are beginning to build programs that focus on that sort of hands-on learning. Biological sciences has become a quantitative endeavor, changing over from a long successful period as a descriptive endeavor. So understanding quantitation, statistics, computation is really important. Developing a broad literacy across a spectrum of scientific approaches is really important, and we have a very rich research environment here that does that. But integration, as I've been saying, is really key. And so now we're trying to develop ways to get those trainees together so they can see each other, talk to each other, see how their different approaches and aspirations can meld to be able to inform each other and to do really bold things. And I think that's the next frontier.
We've been speaking today with Keith Yamamoto, PhD, Vice Chancellor for Science, Policy, and Strategy, Executive Vice Dean for Research at the School of Medicine, and Director of the Precision Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. You can learn more about his work by going to yamamotolab.ucsf.edu. Dr. Yamamoto, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
House Speaker Paul Ryan falsely claimed that, quote, because of Obamacare, Medicare is going broke. The law actually improved Medicare's financing, and the program isn't going broke. Ryan made the remark in an interview on Fox News a few days after the presidential election. And Ryan's remark took us back to the 2012 election, which was filled with scary Medicare claims. As we said back then, both the Romney and Obama campaigns had proposed ways to shore up Medicare's shaky financing, but they disagreed on how best to do that. Let's start with the idea that Medicare is going broke. It isn't. One part of Medicare, though, is expected to face financial shortfalls in the future without changes to either revenues or spending or both. That's Part A, which covers payments to hospitals and is funded by a payroll tax that goes into a trust fund. It's that Part A trust fund that's expected to run out of money. The current exhaustion date is 2028, according to the latest report from the Medicare trustees. But Part A would still have revenue through payroll tax receipts. Those revenues would cover 87% of expenditures in 2028. As for Ryan's claim that Obamacare had worsened Medicare's financing, that's not the case either. In fact, the law both expanded Medicare funding and cut the growth of future spending. The trustees' 2010 report estimated that the ACA had added 12 years to the life of the Part A trust fund, postponing the exhaustion date from 2017 to 2029 or 2028 under an alternative scenario in which not all of the ACA changes are enacted. Cutting future growth in spending improves Medicare's financing. That's the opposite of what Ryan claimed. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. As the saying goes, music soothes the savage beast. And according to a recent study conducted by Queen's University in Belfast, Ireland, there's some empirical data to back that up. Children suffering from a variety of behavioral and emotional conditions who were exposed to music therapy in addition to traditional therapies had far better outcomes than those children in a control group that offered traditional therapy without music therapy.
It's not a matter of them being given music or choosing music. They actually make music along with the music therapist assisting them. So the idea is for them to express themselves through music.
Lead researcher Dr. Sam Porter said there's been anecdotal evidence that music improves mood in children and adolescents as well as adults, but his study revealed just how effective the music therapy was.
Our primary outcome was an improvement in communication. Now, there were two very interesting secondary outcomes, levels of depression and levels of self-esteem. And in the secondary outcomes, we find a statistically significant difference between the control group and the intervention group.
It showed over time more interaction with their surroundings and a better response to the traditional therapies as well.
I mean, that's one of the marvelous things about music therapy. There are no side effects, and it is a productive way of getting kids to improve their health. So it's really satisfying to know that it's also an effective way of doing it.
The study was conducted in conjunction with the Northern Ireland Music Therapy Trust, which sees the promising findings as an incentive to incorporate this relatively low-cost therapy to enhance outcomes for the youth population. A simple, targeted music therapy approach, age-appropriate and showing great efficacy in improving outcomes for young patients with minimal side effects and lasting benefits. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.